Yes, it's Fourth Estate for the week beginning Monday the 20th of April. Live on 2SER Radio and across the Community Radio Network. This is your weekly look at the world of journalism and the media. My name's Jack Fisher. Tonight joining us, Michael Bodie, media and film writer at The Australian. Hi, Michael. We've also got Chris Graham, editor of New Matilda. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Jack.
And Chris Berg, research fellow at the Institute of Public Affairs and columnist with ABC's The Drum. Hi, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
Very welcome. Now, as always, if you've got something to say about what we're discussing tonight, you can get in touch via Twitter. Our handle is FourthEstateAU, or letters, no numbers. Now, over the weekend, SBS sport presenter Scott McIntyre posted 5 tweets on Saturday afternoon on the legacy of the Anzacs. Here's what he wrote. The cultification of an imperialist invasion of a foreign nation that Australia had no quarrel with is against all ideals of modern society. Wonder if the poorly read, largely white nationalist drinkers and gamblers pause today to consider the horror that all mankind suffered, remembering the summary execution, widespread rape and theft committed by those brave Anzacs in Egypt, Palestine and Japan, not forgetting that the largest single-day terrorist attacks in history were committed by this nation and their allies in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Well, the calls for McIntyre's sacking and even deportation were swift. The hashtag SackScottMcIntyre was begun, and by 9 p.m. that evening, the Communications Minister Malcolm Turnbull had weighed in, saying he found it difficult to think of more offensive or inappropriate comments. SBS Managing Director Michael Abade also denounced the comments at the same time, and by midday the next day, SBS announced that Scott McIntyre's employment at SBS had been terminated. There's now been a petition launched today on change.org to have his employment reinstated. Malcolm Turnbull tweeted that it's difficult to think of more offensive tweets than those by Scott McIntyre. Is it in fact difficult?
As a large white drinker?
No, it's definitely not. I could think of far more offensive stuff. This sort of ranked in the, you're on Twitter, you see someone be a doofus and you move on. I'm sort of a bit flummoxed by the, the timing was particularly insensitive. You've got to grant that. And his facts weren't entirely correct. But in the greater scheme of things, I've got to say, I'm more horrified by down in Melbourne at the moment. You've got an AFL coach who's biffed an opposition supporter, and the footy media is getting right in behind the coach saying, of course, that was exactly what he should have done.
Yeah.
And I just find that a bit more abhorrent than words that were just clumsy, possibly drunken, and you just move on.
Chris Berg, just how offensive were these comments?
Look, I think they were offensive, and the broad brush criticism of all Anzacs as potential war criminals is obviously offensive, and it was a sensitive time as well. But it's turned into something more than that. It's turned into a proxy, it appears, for the entire discussion about Anzac Day and the role of the Anzacs in the Australian national consciousness as well. And I think when we discuss the consequences of his tweets and the way it played out, I think it's very hard for a lot of people to get away from their views on Anzac in general, rather than talking about it as an employment law thing or even just a free speech issue.
Chris Graham, I think what he's given voice to here is a sense of discomfort, which a lot of Australians perhaps feel around the jingoism. But to be clear, he's accused Australian soldiers 100 years ago of having been thieves and rapists. Do you think those who've come to his defence have perhaps sanitised those comments a little bit?
Oh, look, maybe some have. I haven't. I do think there were some rapists and thieves among the Anzacs. I don't think that was the norm, though. But that's war. War's an appalling thing, and I think that's the point, however clumsily he made it, that he was trying to make. And that's the problem with offence. I wasn't offended by what he said. I am frustrated, like many others, with the, as he puts it, the cultification of Anzac. I think it glorifies war too much, and I think we've built a bit of a myth on it. But I wasn't offended by it. I was offended by Miranda Devine's tweet on Saturday on Jazz Hands in relation to David Pocock. I thought that was quite offensive, but I don't think she should be sacked for it.
Now, Fairfax Media's Michael Strom has tweeted, imagine if Russia's communications minister rebuked a journo for criticising hypocrisy around military commemorations, and then that journo was then sacked. Michael, wouldn't that raise alarm bells for many?
I was surprised that the communications minister even commented on something sort of trivial and not, it was going to get dealt with without him weighing in. And he's weighing in a particularly sensitive time in the sort of relationship between him and the public broadcasters. So SBS has not only survived some huge cuts and argy-bargy last year with the federal government, they're now trying to get an increase to their advertising. And the managing director, they're trying to get that through Parliament. And the managing director, Michael Abid, is got to make nice with the communications minister and has been doing so for more than 12 months. So I think all that sort of subtext to it's just confused it a bit and made it a bit more, I wouldn't use the word nefarious, but more interesting than perhaps it otherwise should have been. But I just don't think the communications minister really should have been bothering with stuff like that when he's got matters of real consequence that can change things that he's got to look after.
Like an NBN or a copper wires.
Precisely.
Chris Graham, just how problematic do you think those comments by Malcolm Turnbull were in the context of it all?
Oh, look, it obviously added fuel to the fire. Ironically, if you believe in Scott's free speech, you believe in Malcolm's free speech, but it's free speech from a minister, which obviously has a much greater effect. I tend to agree with Michael. I don't think it's something that the communications minister really should have bothered expressing a view publicly, but when he did, it went ballistic. I think he highlighted it. If someone else had highlighted it, it may well have caught fire as well, but it was Anzac Day after all.
Chris Burke, what do you think about Malcolm Turnbull weighing in on this one?
Look, I don't see that there was anything wrong with Malcolm Turnbull weighing in on it. And if there hadn't been the follow-up and if the guy hadn't been sacked, then we wouldn't have thought a word about it. In fact, you could argue that if the minister finds something offensive that's been done by an agency within his portfolio, he has a responsibility to follow it up. How that gets played out is a decision of the SBS's much vaunted independence. Now, I'm not at all convinced that the reason he was sacked was because Malcolm Turnbull raised the issue. There are reports today that the reason he was sacked is because when asked to apologise and recant what he say, he flat out refused. Now, that is a matter between him and SBS. There's no suggestion at all that the communications minister asked him to be sacked, and I'm sure defenders of SBS independence would be horrified to believe that was what happened.
So the minister makes communication with the managing director of SBS late on a Saturday night, drawing his attention to someone's tweets, and you're saying that the SBS is so independent that it would act of its own volition after that? I mean, the connection between
nonsense. I'm not suggesting anything of the sort. What I am suggesting is that the responsibility for sacking an employer of SBS ultimately rests with SBS.
That's
itself.
Almost word for word now, what the communications minister said today. And you know, as we said before, SBS is under immense pressure commercially and politically at the moment. And the communications minister made contact with the managing director on Saturday night about this issue. There was no other way it was going to play out. They couldn't even wait till Monday morning to get rid of McIntyre. I think it's
clear from what happened that Malcolm Turnbull's role played a factor in his sacking. I don't think there's any doubt, really any doubt in anybody. If you're going to be reasonable about the debate, I think you have to accept Turnbull played a pretty significant role.
And I don't think it would have played out any differently if he didn't play a role. I think SBS probably would have dumped him. But nevertheless, he's muddied the water significantly.
Okay, well, Channel 10's Hugh Rimmington, who is on the board of veteran support organisation Soldier On, well, he tweeted, "Wrong call, Michael Abid, who is the SBS managing director. You had options other than to sack him." Michael, what were those options?
Well, I haven't investigated the SBS employment policy, but look, I don't think he was sacked because he didn't recant, and the tweets are still up there, and McIntyre, I think, is not resiling from what he said, and I think he wants people to discuss what he said. But SBS has explicitly stated that he's been terminated, his employment's been terminated, because he's broken the code of conduct at SBS, brought SBS into disrepute, and also broken the social media policy. So that's pretty straight up. Now, whether the process for employment contracts at SBS allows him to be summarily dismissed, I don't know. I suspect McIntyre is getting a lot of advice and seeking a lot of advice, and I think it'll be an ongoing issue as to whether he takes it to a tribunal this week or not.
Or summarily executed, for that matter. Indeed. Hugh Remington also wrote that while Scott McIntyre's tweets were untimely, immature, he said, and in one case offensively wrong, lest we forget our diggers also died for free speech. Chris Berg, is this a free speech issue if someone's job is being threatened for what they've said online?
No, I don't think it is. Now, that's not to say that I think that sacking him was the right idea. I think that we can, at the same time, say that it's not strictly a free speech issue, it's a issue of contract, but that it was the wrong thing to do. Now, I do think that barring any hints of discussions that were had on Sunday morning, I do think that sacking someone for a series of ill-advised and even offensive tweets is the wrong thing to do, particularly in this context where there's no suggestion that there was any deeper issue with his employment. But but I'm not convinced that it's a strictly freedom of speech issue. It is a matter of contracts, and SBS has a right to manage its employees and to manage the profile of one of its more highly prominent employees, a soccer commentator.
Well, Chris, can I ask you then, when Andrew Bolt wrote what he wrote about Aboriginal people and found himself in violation of the law, was that a matter of free speech?
Yeah, absolutely, because we're talking about
really
two totally separate things. Yeah. Hold on, bear with me. If you asked me a question, you really would like the answer, presumably.
Well, you gave it, but fire away.
What we're talking about are two totally separate responses, one of which is action in the federal court. The other is the end of a contract that they both agreed to. The Racial Discrimination Act and voluntarily entered into contracts are totally, totally different. He is very, very free to go about and say whatever he wants about the ANZACs, but not in the employ of an organisation that requires him not to say such things or say specifically offensive things.
But we're talking about
This automatic confirmation between contract law and political freedom of speech principles and the law, we're talking about the Racial Discrimination Act, I think is a deliberate muddying of the waters by people who just want to run political agendas and rather than talk about serious legislative change.
But someone can tweet about Anzac Day and a journalist and lose their job, but another journalist can breach the law and write offensively about Aboriginal people, and that's a matter of free speech. They're exactly the same principle.
No, not in the slightest. Not at all. Not at all. We're talking about legal constraints versus voluntary contracts voluntarily entered into. They are totally different things. When you and I incorporate to set up an organization that has one standard of responsibility or one standard of conduct, if either one of us breaches that conduct, we are perfectly legitimate to be excluded from that contract. The Racial Discrimination Act isn't like a individual contract. It is totally different.
Okay. Now, it's interesting that in their statement on the matter, SBS apologised for the offence and even harm caused by McIntyre's tweets. And in the same breath, they chose to defend their support for the ANZACs and all the amount of time and effort that they'd given over to the ANZAC centenary coverage. Michael, all the networks have obviously made a big thing out of celebrating, marking this and covering this centenary. How much do you think that pressure would have contributed to his swift dismissal?
I don't think there was any pressure. I think just what he said was a bit sort of ridiculous and totally insensitive at that time. I don't think just because it was the 100th anniversary, which people embraced on the day. It was funny that all the TV previously hadn't really worked, hadn't rated well, but on the day the ABC and others got some huge ratings. I find it interesting that the ABC had its own documentary, Lest We Forget What, on Wednesday night, I think, presented by Kate Orbison. And it sort of discussed the mythology of Anzac Day in Gallipoli in a somewhat naive way, but it sort of raised some contentious points and went straight through to the keeper, and no one sort of really followed on, which was interesting. But no, I don't think there was any pressure. I think this is just one instance of someone being a bit untimely and insensitive, and an organisation acting. And I think there is a difference in some degree between him working for a public organisation and Bolt working for a private company. His employer, which is essentially my employer, will argue it lives with the consequences of whatever he says, and when it's unhappy, it doesn't employ him anymore, as long as he... So I think there's a public trust that employers at the ABC and SBS have that commercial organisations might argue that they still have it, but they are also, they live and die by their revenues.
I think your organisation should, based on public trust as well. But
we do have, I know, we do have it. But
well, I think the standards should be the same.
Yes, and that's an ongoing argument.
It'll be
an admirable
stretch forever. Yeah.
Let's move on, because I want to get to this really interesting topic, which I think has come out of this whole thing, which is about journalists' Twitter accounts and profiles. Now, the MEAA, the Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance, has said that while journalists are now being required to use social media to promote their work and for their employers' marketing purposes, social media policies of employers are inflexible and deny staff the right to have and express a personal opinion. Chris Graham, what should a journalist's Twitter feed really be?
It should be the personal views of the journalist, and if the employer's asking that journalist to tweet about things he's done, it should include that as well. But I don't think you can beat a journalist or any individual up for tweeting their personal view. I understand Chris Berg's point about contracts being contracts, but if a media organisation is going to exploit a journalist's personality and his or her Twitter account for their own personal gain, it has to be a two-way street.
Michael Bode, what should a journalist's Twitter feed be?
I agree. I don't think you even need a social media policy in it.
Okay.
I mean, it's just don't be an idiot.
Yeah, and,
yeah, yeah, but that is the policy.
So, well, yeah. You know, and I'm employed for my personality and my opinions and my news. And I think that's the interesting point now, is that journalists aren't objective, passive observers of what is happening and what they're reporting. And I think a lot of people aren't ready for getting out into the public space. There's plenty of journos who just aren't good at it.
Yeah.
Expressing their opinions. So, look, ironic. And you know, I think it's beholden upon some media organisations to perhaps train a bit better in the ethics and the values and the, you know, whys and wherefores of how to do it, rather than the technical aspects of it.
You're on Fourth Estate. My guest tonight, Chris Berg from the Institute of Public Affairs, Chris Graham from New Matilda, and Michael Bode from The Australian. Now, the Australian media watchdog has finally released its report into Today FM's infamous royal prank call, and it's found that Today FM breached a condition of its broadcast licence. You'll remember in 2012 when Today FM hosts called the hospital where Duchess of Cambridge Kate Middleton was being treated for morning sickness. Pretending to be the Queen and Prince Philip, the radio hosts tricked two nurses into speaking on Middleton's condition, and the secret recording of the prank call went to air shortly after one nurse took her own life. Now, the ACMA, the Australian Media and Communications Authority, has found that Today FM was in breach of rules that prohibit the broadcast of statements by identifiable persons without their consent, and which also prohibit participants in live-hosted entertainment programs from being treated in a highly demeaning or exploitative manner. I spoke a little earlier to Australia's foremost media law expert, Mark Pearson. Here's what he had to say.
As far as its punishment goes, it now has to decide what, amongst quite an extensive suite of sanctions it has available, which sanction it will apply. So in the past, it's been criticised a lot for basically hitting networks over the fingers, wrapping them over the knuckles with a feather rather than any severe punishment. So it'll be very interesting to see what they actually decide in this case.
Indeed it will. Michael Bode, Today FM fought tooth and nail to have this report kept undercover. Is the station still not taking full responsibility for the call that went to air?
They've been protecting, on behalf of the commercial radio industry, a few possible precedents. Their biggest beef in the most recent legal challenge was the ACMA made a judgment that they'd breached the Surveillance Act, which suggests that they have done a criminal act. And the radio industry is basically saying, hang on, ACMA, you can't, that's for the cops to decide. And the police have subsequently decided that they did not breach the Surveillance Act. So there's been a lot of argy-bargy over that, because it did open a can of worms. But I think look, again, we're in a sort of weirdly political environment where the ACMA has to, as your guest just, as Mark just said, has to do something because they've let Today FM and particularly the Kyle Sanderland show off for so long. Not that this is Sanderland's, but you really feel as though they've been waiting to whack Today for a long time, and they've finally found a means with which, or a case in which they can do it. And I think it'll be a pretty, again, I think it'll be pretty toothless. I mean, if you look at Today FM, they're last in Sydney. They're an absolute basket case at the moment. So ACMA was looking at shutting them, taking their license off them for a few hours. They'd do that in the middle of the day. You know, Today FM would lose $30 basically for the advertising for a couple of hours. They'll institute another broadcast license condition. I just don't see that there's anything that they're really going to do, but they're making a song and dance because they think they should and can.
Well, yeah, so no commercial Australian television or radio station has had its license cancelled or suspended in the past. ACMA has not ruled out suspending Today FM for a number of hours. Chris Berg, would this amount to anything more than a slap on the wrist, do you think?
Look, I'll just pick you up on that. Back in the 1920s, they actually suspended radio broadcasters for political reasons.
I stand corrected.
Labor Party broadcasters that were pulled down. But no, I mean, it's not going to be much of a slap on the wrist, and nor should it be. I mean, we've just had this long conversation about freedom of speech. Now we're talking about the possibility that a government regulator would pull a radio station off the air because it believes that it breached a ethical or moral code. Now, I have no interest in defending the actions of Today FM, and I think what they did was very, very questionable and very problematic. But the idea that people would be braying for some sort of punishment to free radio broadcasting, I think, is really abhorrent and really, really dangerous and ultimately very scary, particularly if what's happening is ACMA just going for a scalp just because it sees some sort of weakness in order to get revenge on Kyle Sanderland. I think that's really problematic.
Yeah, Chris Graham?
Yeah, look, I've struggled with this story from day one. I think it's a terrible tragedy, but I must admit, I never saw at the time that what they were doing was bullying, and I never saw that it would have... No one really saw that it could have the outcome it had until it had. I mean, some people, of course, have warned of it, but I feel very sorry for the broadcasters. I don't think if they suspend Today FM for a few hours on Sydney Radio, I think we'll all dance a jig, but for other reasons. I mean, I just think the whole thing's... I think the whole thing's a tragedy, and I think it's being exploited now to some extent, but, you know, life goes on. And Sydney Radio without Today FM for 3 hours, I think we'll all survive.
I think we will. You're on Fourth Estate. My name's Jack Fisher, talking to Chris Graham of New Matilda, Michael Bodie of The Australian, and Chris Berg from the Institute of Public Affairs. Now, last week, the ABC launched Charlie Pickering's new show, The Weekly. It's aimed at bringing in a new audience of younger viewers and very clearly models itself on some of the news satire staples out of the US, such as The Daily Show and John Oliver's Last Week Tonight. Very much in the style of Oliver, The Weekly featured a long explainer monologue to address the topic of internet piracy. Michael Bodie, is The Weekly trying too hard to be John Oliver's Last Week Tonight, or Australia's Daily Show for that matter?
I was just disappointed that he's been given this 20-week run, and this is the most shameless rip-off of American comedy since... Well, it's the most shameless rip-off of comedy since the BBC ripped off John Clark's The Games. And before that, since Steve Vizard ripped off Letterman back in the old and black and white days when I was growing up. But it was just a lost opportunity. And it was such a rip-off on... Even the theme music was almost like a... been ripped off from Bill Maher's show. I thought there's got to be a better way. And if I want the new satire, you know, we're getting the best of the world at the moment from the US. I mean, we've had this, I hesitate to use the term golden age, but I mean, Stephen Colbert is probably as good as there ever will be at that game. Jon Stewart is not bad. And I just thought, They've got good comedians there. They've got some bucks. They've got to do something. They've got to come up with something original.
Chris Graham, part of the new satire genre is to lampoon the news genre itself.
Yeah.
Is there anything these shows do any better than something such as Frontline?
Oh, well, look, they're based on the truth, even though I would argue strongly so was Frontline. But they're based on factual day-to-day events. I happen to love The Daily Show. I love Colbert as well, but I love The Daily Show even more. And I'm less a fan of John Oliver. I know I'm in the minority there, although I still think John Oliver is fantastic. And I also happen to be a huge Charlie Pickering fan. So I must admit, I haven't seen the show yet. I'm not a consumer of television, if I were to be honest, but I will make an effort to watch it. And I take Michael's comments on board. I think if they've ripped off the format so closely, that's a bit problematic. But I do think Australia is ripe for this sort of format. I think we need to make it a bit more local and give it a bit more originality. But I think it is a fantastic way to get news across to a younger audience that disengages from news.
And really quickly, Michael, you wrote that ABC's recent black comedy had an edge that The Weekly might not. Does a show like The Weekly really challenge its audience at all, or does it just reassure them, as some have said of The Daily Show?
Yeah, I think it does reassure in some respects. And in a way, it's a bit unfair to compare those two comedies because they're totally different in what their mission is. Charlie's mission, or The Weekly's mission, is to get a big audience on a Wednesday night and try and relive the grand old Spicks and Specks days for the ABC. Something like black comedy is about breeding a whole new batch of comedians from the Indigenous community. So that was a bit glib, that comparison.
Okay, that's it from us on Fourth Estate this week. Don't forget you can check out all of our podcasts on the 2SER website. You can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Thank you to our guests, Michael Bodie from The Australian, Chris Graham from New Matilda, and Chris Berg from the Institute of Public Affairs. My name's Jack Fisher. We'll be back at the same time next week.